You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Okay, so I am here with Grandmaster Flash, who is most recently the author of The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash. Flash, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, adventures, why not the chronicles or the episodes? Did you have any input into this particular title? Why the adventures over any other noun?
Because the adventures goes outside of just music or just goes outside of hip-hop chronicles. This particular book, I wrote it for people who don't have perfect families, for people who don't have perfect careers, for people who grow up with someone that you love and you put your life in their hands and then they cross you. This book is for people who, in the end results, after going through what you go through, forgive.
Yeah, gotcha.
You know, how do you solve a drug addiction, a real bad drug addiction? How do I survive? Yeah. I talk about these things because I was in one.
I want to ask you about the developments in the last 30 years. I mean, you pioneered cutting, scratching, and
no,
all that.
Scratching.
Okay.
Not use that word.
All right.
Cutting sugar, rubbing, as we call it.
Okay, fair enough. But we've seen a great increase in digital tools, and I know that you also scoured through records.
Yeah.
I have to ask, now that MP3 is omnipresent, I mean, how does one find the obscure titles these days, and how has digital tools or computers affected the way that you do your work? And do you find that there are limitations that have been lifted because of this, or what's the deal?
The obscurity still exists with me because what I already have is obscure. So with the digital age and new files, they don't have everything on the internet. Like, for example, Mr. C's here is getting ready to interview me. Like, a lot of his collection probably aren't on MP3s. Would you agree with that, Mr. C? That a lot of the records you got aren't even available on the internet. There's quite a few records that are just not still available because somebody either don't know about them or they just not posted.
Yeah.
So I can name 10 or 15 songs, but I won't. But
if you listen to the Wheels of Steel today, as I have actually a couple of times, you can actually hear your hands on the turntables, whereas you can't always hear, say, someone who is just doing a mashup. You don't hear that analog quality, so I'm wondering how things have adjusted for you in light of this. I mean, how do you keep the analog part of things legitimate and real, or how do digital tools help you as well?
Okay, first of all, I'm a scientist before I'm a DJ. So pushing the envelope for new technology, I'm always with that because I was ahead of my time 33 years ago. So, you know, now that it's become things like Serato, Torque, Final Scratch, Track to Scratch, which is what I use, you know, you still have to drive it in the same fashion. Meaning that if you were a great mixer, a great DJ in the analog world with vinyl, you still have to drive it the same way in digital. So if you was whack in the analog world, you will be whack in the digital world. So the real fact of the matter is follow through how you play your songs and what songs you play. That still separates the boys from the men and the ladies from the women. So the modern technology has sort of brought in convenience. You could put 15,000, 20,000 songs on a hard drive and carry those, where at one point, we as DJs used to have like three or four guys that used to lift our boxes, you know, so that isn't the case anymore. I carry less vinyl and I have more in my laptop.
Are there disadvantages then to vinyl over digital? I mean, do you miss operating exclusively on vinyl? Because I know the other question I had is, because you constantly use your hands all throughout these 33 years, I mean, what did you do to keep your hands in shape? You're almost like a surgeon on the turntable. So I'm wondering.
I still am. I mean, and they have these things called time-coded vinyl. And a time-coded, like, it's vinyl and it still has to read what's on the hard drive and you still have to physically play the file. So those things are still the case, and those things haven't changed. You know, so the actual mechanics on how to be a DJ, so to speak, those things still exist. I mean, it's just a special piece of time-coded vinyl. It's called SMPTE vinyl, and that there tells a laptop how to move the vinyl. So you still have to, it comes in a kit. It's two pieces of vinyl, but especially time-coded vinyl that you put on each turntable, and that reads the file. So you still physically have to do what I invented, still. And you have to do it in such a way where you can still rock the crowd. If you did it whack in the analog world, like I said, you'd be whack in the digital world.
Now, you obtained your first set of turntables from a rather illicit source. They're referred to as thugs in the book. And Duck, who you say actually originated.
This was my first set, but one of my earlier
sets. Your first major set, this was like the best top-of-the-line turntables.
Actually, it was the amplifier. The turntables were pretty good. They were Thorin's TD-125Cs. They were awful, though. They didn't work very well. My first really major set was by this little-known company known as Technique, and it was the model SL-20. But some of my stuff was pilfered from from this big disco club up the block called the Hunts Point Palace. You know, and then what I found, what was really great about it is these guys bought in speakers maybe the size of these boxes and amplifiers with big LED windows. I'm like, what is this? So I had somewhat of a half makeshift and half Hunts Point Palace as a set. And I would, and my oldest sister's husband was the super of the building. So any empty apartments I would make.
Yeah.
Do house parties in it.
Yeah. I have a question also about your relationship with Sylvia Robinson. I mean, the scenario in this book paints a system of exploitation over a number of years, and I'm wondering why you didn't catch on to this earlier, because they're taking away the car that you had, they're taking away the lease for it. And another question kind of related to this is I know you fought in court to get your name back, but you actually rail against the message that you weren't really involved in this, and I'm curious as to...
Of course I was involved in all the songs. And the cars was loaned to us, or at least we thought they were given to us. This is after we were in the deal. They didn't give us the cars before. You know, so, I mean, when we went into it, we didn't know. We were craftsmen. So, I mean, your question, I don't really understand your question, but, you know, upon entering the deal, you know, we were told that if we didn't sign the deal immediately, you know, that she would pick another group, which was just sort of like a deception for us. You know, so three of us were saying we need to wait and show this to somebody. We didn't understand. Hold up, y'all, I'm doing an interview. Didn't understand the word attorney at that point.
Yeah. But did you consider actually going to an attorney to check the terms of the contract to find out about publication rights and the like?
I don't think you understand what I just said. When we was handed this piece of paper, we didn't understand what attorney, we didn't know what the word attorneys was.
Got it.
Didn't know what that was. We knew that we had to take it somewhere. And like I said, in the book, I brought my paperwork to my sister Penny. She knew that it had to be brought to somebody that can decipher it. Raheem brought his paperwork home to his mother. So Raheem's mother and my sister had both decided that something needed to be looked at. But by that time, she had called the group up and said, I needed to meet with y'all immediately. And by this time, we had to basically make a move or walk away. I personally wanted to walk away because it was too much. She wanted to rush us into signing too quick because I didn't know where to take the paperwork, but I knew that we had to take this somewhere to get it looked at, because when I looked at it, it just looked like I didn't know what it was. I couldn't decipher what it was, didn't understand. But three of us was like, we need to take this opportunity, otherwise we blow it, and three of us were saying no. So we went into that whole thing argumentative. And then in the end result, 4-2. Me and Raheem, we lost. So I was the last person to sign it, and to turn it into my stomach. I knew that something was wrong. Did I know? I knew my craft, but did I know about administrative and business? No, I didn't know. So I don't understand your question sounds a little crazy, but okay.
Well, I'm just curious as to what the conditions were during those times. Was it pretty much an ultimatum if you got a deal with Sugar Hill? Was this the situation going on there? I mean, that it was just basically an all-or-nothing contract that was offered to you or to anybody else during that time? I mean, why didn't people know about attorneys? I mean, it's just, you just wanted to make the music?
Why didn't people know about attorneys? Because we came from we wasn't told about attorneys. We didn't know about that. We just knew that we are, this paperwork needed to be signed by somebody that could decipher what it meant. And that's all I knew.
And you're perfectly fine with the message then? That's what I gather.
No, I'm not perfectly fine with the message, because Grandmaster Flash and the Phrase 5 consisted of one DJ and five MCs. And if you play the message, there's one rapper on it.
Yeah.
One rapper from the Furious 5, and I had the best vocalist on the planet. So when she decided to settle four of the five MCs is what I hated her for. You understand?
Got it.
That's how it went down. It's like if me and you create something from the ground up and then we get to the mountaintop and I cut you off, something's wrong. Or if you cut me off, something is seriously wrong. And that's what happened here. It's like it should have been five MCs on every record that we made or don't make it. That's the problem I have with the message. That particular song has the personnel is incomplete. So we go down in history where you guys only know who I am and only who Melly Mel is. You guys don't know who Scorpio is. You guys don't know who Cowboy is. You guys don't know who Raheem is. You know, you guys don't know Scorpio because they're not on the record.
Yeah.
So my biggest problem is why All Five of My Boys is not on his record.
What can you do really to reinstitute these names? Is there anything that you can do aside from just
essentially? History is history. It's done. History is history. Kids have already grown up. Can't do anything about it. And that's the only problem I have with them records, because it went from the message, only one rapper, to New York, and only, you know, only one rapper. Then why'd you call them Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five records? Because there are groups that where one of the members kind of jumps off for a minute and does a solo record, and then he comes back. Like that, that's commonplace. So why did you call them records Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five records? Yeah. If you only had one of my boys on the record, why? And why did you exploit my name?
I also wanted to ask you about Ray Chandler and playing at the Audubon Ballroom. I mean, this was a huge deal, and yet you kind of severed relationships with him. I mean,
with
Ray Chandler?
Didn't sever relationships. We just grew. As I went further into the record business was in his area. His business was more the parties, the clubs. And even to this day, that's what he does. You know, I went on to do other things. Finally learned about attorneys and managements and accountants, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So sort of moved on. That's what happened. I mean, we didn't even sever in bad terms. I seen him like 3 weeks ago, gave him a hug. Gotcha. You know, you grow.
Yeah. So that's really what it is about being in the music business, growing essentially, or accounting for the fact of growing, or is this not something that one can do when one gets an early start?
I don't understand your question.
How does an aspiring musician or an aspiring DJ account for the idea of growing in people, or is it just all too fast? Did you experience it just too fast to account for this?
Too fast? No, I don't think it was too fast. I think it was trust. Trusting someone that everything is going to be okay. And if she would have nurtured us, that would have been the Def Jam of today, because we were the franchise. That's what it comes down to, so it's her loss, not mine, so I'm still here.
Well, Flash, thanks very much for taking the time out.
Thank you. All right.
Okay, so I am here with Karen Abbott, who is the author of Sin and the Second City. Karen, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I understand this book actually had an original title that ended up being one of the chapters in this book. How did you get from Getting Everlaid to Sin and the Second City? I mean, it's a very flagrant entendre.
Yeah, I know. I actually liked, you know, I also called it Whores at War in my head for a while.
Really?
But Getting Everlaid was the title that Random House bought it under. And I, you know, stupidly assumed that it was going to stay that, being that I have no idea about how Random House was doing its marketing.
Yeah.
But Getting Everlaid was from the sisters claiming that their name originated that phrase, which I don't think is true. I think it came from the biblical phrase to lie with. But the Everlaid sisters sort of appropriate it and were very skillful at making people believe that their name was the source of that, or at least, you know, tying their name to that phrase and making it part of the popular lexicon.
Yeah.
But my editor at some point very late in the game was just like, we need a new title, you know, something that's a little bit more, has a little bit more weight and import. So that's what she came up with.
Yeah. I'm curious because it's interesting that something like Everlaid, as well as Decentized, which you point to later in the book.
Decentized.
These are verbs that didn't quite make it in the 21st century.
Yeah, decentized. I'm surprised.
Yeah.
You think that some reformers today would have latched on to that
You'd think, in light of the fundamentalist furor that is going on as we speak.
Yes.
But I mean, how much of your research is oriented around these associations? Because obviously this is a very literary approach in a certain way to the facts that exist. There's a lot of fanciful language that you use that really gets us into this particular atmospheric context.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, does something like this originate from the facts, or does it originate from a phrase, or does it originate from a verb, as we sort of suggested here? Or
you know, I think a lot of the phrases that came in the book already were in existence, and the characters in the book just sort of latched onto them. You know, I'm kind of ashamed to admit that I spent like 2 days researching the etymology of Susie Poontang. Where Poontang might have come from.
Did you come up to any conclusion here?
It was an Asian, a Chinese phrase that had to do with prostitute, a derivative of prostitute. And I think she probably also latched onto that for herself. I doubt it. It was sort of a chicken and the egg question, but I'm pretty sure that she probably appropriated it for herself and took it to America.
yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if you didn't really concern yourself so much with how these phrases at least entered into the vernacular for a few decades and then disappeared. I mean, is this not as important as, say, for example, the existing
record, or I mean, it seems to me that since you use this in the book, that it would in fact be just as pertinent as the details of the figures, the pictures you have of the Everglades Club, which looks actually quite a nice place to go. Actually.
Yes, it was quite a nice place to go. You know, I don't know why Decent Ties didn't latch on. There were a couple other things, like some people ask me why I use the word harlot so much in the book. I actually remember the one thing I remember from Janet Maslin's review was she brought that up. And I was sitting there thinking, like, well, what else was I going to use?
Yeah.
In the parlance of the times, I wanted to stick as close as I could to the parlance of the times, which is why when I came upon a word like decentize, I thought that was great. You know,
yeah.
Here's something that people were actually using in context of what they were trying to do at the time. But harlot was what they were called. They weren't called hookers. They weren't really called prostitutes. They were called harlots or sporting girls. And I was like, how many times could I use the phrase sporting girl without somebody wanting to throw the book across the room? You know,
yeah.
Sort of. And it's also an ambiguous phrase. Like if I say it today, if you're like sporting girl, what is a sporting girl?
But I think harlot of someone is pretty wearing a sports bra.
Exactly. I've had people say, you know, what is a sporting girl? And but harlot is pretty unmistakably what it is. So that was that. But I did try to stay true to the vernacular and the parlance of the times as much as I could.
Well, this brings up another question, because we're looking at these events a century later. And in many cases, you rely almost exclusively on one source. I think, for example, of Colonel McDuff, who's this very colorful attorney who frequents the parlor. And there's this one particular anecdote of him with the chicken leg sternly waving this and saying, well, I'm not going to leave until I'm done and relaxed.
Yes.
But this only comes from one source, which is the Edgar Lee Masters article in Town and Country. So this makes me wonder whether one can really know the truth if you're relying exclusively on one source. Are there certain ground rules that you set in terms of establishing descriptive details along these lines on saying, well, or is it a case in this case, or in many cases throughout the book, that there is really just one source that supports this particular argument? I mean, how do you have differing gradients of truth if you're relying only on one source?
Well, that's a good question. Edgar Lee Masters, I considered some sources more reliable than others, as I guess everybody does who's doing nonfiction. Edgar Lee Masters I considered pretty reliable because he was very close friends with the Everly sisters, and he was there all the time. He and Theodore Dreiser apparently just never left. I mean, they were at the Everly Club all day, all night, all the time. But it was in terms of anecdotes like that where I thought a lot of them were probably stories passed on between visitors and between friends and between clients. It takes on a folkloric quality a little bit, and I'm sure that comes across in the writing of it. Where other things are more factually based in terms of the historic record and things that were in the government, you know, the annals of the government, and some of those purity journals. I tried to check them several times just because they were sort of documenting U.S. history, and it was sort of not only easier to do that, but I thought probably more important than just, you know, the anecdotes of the club. Automatically we're going to just sort of take on that sort of apocryphal feel after a while.
Yeah. Is this also why the Charles Washburn book was a very good source? Or was this really the only biography that existed of the Everly sisters?
Well, it was the only full biography that existed of theirs. And I say full with a grain of salt, because he did not tell a lot of truth about their lives. The sisters were fantastic liars. It's one of the things that made them so much fun to research. You never knew when they were telling the truth and when they weren't. So I dug down into actual historical records besides Charles Washburn. I didn't believe anything they told him about their personal histories, but I believed what they told him in terms of how the club operated, and because these are things that could be fact-checked elsewhere and were fact-checked elsewhere. So the only time I was really suspect of what they were saying was when they were talking about their own personal backgrounds.
But back to this boisterous attorney, I mean, you have only one source for that. I mean, in what instances was it important to fact-check it against other sources, and in what cases could you let the folklore ride on its own? I mean, you're talking about the truth here, and truth, of course, is objective or subjective, or were you more of a sort of subjective truth-teller here?
Well, in terms of the anecdotes like that, I mean, everybody, it's sort of, if Edgar Lee Masters is the only one who chose to write about Colonel McDuff, you know, what am I going to do about that? It's not like he was a reformer like Clifford Rowe, who had his own extensive body of work and also several articles in the newspapers. You know, if I did a search on Colonel McDuff, probably Edgar Lee Masters' story about him is the only thing that's going to come up. Now, does that mean I exclude it? Of course not. I want to tell a colorful story. Susie Poontang was only written about in one book, but I was like, you know what? This guy was somebody who knew the Everly sisters. He was at the club quite a bit. he remembers Susie Poontang. I'm going to take his word for it on that account. So I'm guessing I gave myself a little bit more leeway when it came to anecdotes about the club, because the Sisters also did encourage storytelling and sort of ways to spread their own mythology and ways to spread their reputation. So I think I was probably a little bit more lenient on that, and then very stringent in terms of the ways that these men and women changed United States history with the Mann Act and the FBI and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, we can
the
get
white
into,
slavery.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll
scare.
Get into that in just a sec. But back to this issue of telling a colorful story.
Yeah.
I mean, Clifford Rowe and Ernest Bell don't exactly come across as the most graceful of characters in this book, and I'm wondering if there's a certain danger when you are arranging events into a narrative of having protagonists and antagonists to this. I was curious about how some of these reformers might have made efforts to talk to the Everleigh sisters. I don't think that Rowe or Bell were necessarily entirely bad guys. I just can't believe that from a human standpoint, and yet to some degree they sometimes do come across this way in your narrative, and I'm wondering if this is really a truthful chronicle of that particular age if you have to tell a colorful story.
You know, I wanted to give the reformers their due. I don't think they were bad men either. I think Ernest Bell was very aptly named. I think he was an earnest man who really believed that these sisters and the whole red light district were ruining the moral fabric of America. And it was his duty, his God-given duty, to rescue these girls who were enslaved. I mean, I really think he believed that. And even if he knew he was exaggerating at times, I think he thought he was doing it for the common good and for the cause, and he was justified in doing that. Clifford Rowe, I think, was a little bit more morally ambiguous in terms of his motives. I think he had some personal ambition that he let get in the way of his own truth-telling, which was interesting to me that everybody in this book was a liar. The Everleigh sisters had their own set of lies, and the reformers, you know, certainly exaggerated things at times. But in terms of the reformers, you know, the whole white slavery scare, I mean, there were years afterward where people debated about whether or not this really occurred and to what degree. I think it was the New York Times who called it the greatest joke ever played upon the American public, which I also don't believe is true. I think, of course, it happened to some extent. You know, women arrived in the city who were unemployed, who didn't speak English, who had no money. Of course, they were open to exploitation. Of course, they were preyed upon. But did it happen to the extent where, you know, 100,000 girls were dying and being held in chains physically, and, you know, all the abolitionist language they borrowed, like, you know, they were being treated worse than the slaves on the old plantations? I don't think any of that was nearly true to the degree they suggested.
But going back to this idea of Rowe and Bell and how you just told me that you don't believe that they were entirely bad men, I mean, the Everleigh sisters were clearly lying, but you do make it a fine point to clarify that, well, they were running a particular club that had standards that treated their women well by saying, oh, well, if you want to leave, you can leave, by making it a very exclusive place, by having three orchestras that they hired.
Yeah.
So, but this particular way of putting things into perspective like this doesn't always apply to Rowe and Bell, and I'm wondering if this is one of the problems of arranging a colorful story.
I don't know. I really tried to give them their due.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to make sure, I didn't want to make fun of them in the narrative.
Sure.
I wanted to make it clear that these men changed American history, and they were a constant daily threat to the Everleigh sisters' lives. And if I muted that threat, if I dismissed them, the whole drama or, you know, the conflict that was happening would have been diluted and would have made for a less interesting narrative, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But it was. I mean, the conflict built and they sort of played off each other. And, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm not a historian. I'm not an academic. And I saw these characters and I saw this colorful time in American history. And I wanted to tell the story of what really happened as factually as I could, but also as entertainingly as I could.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if the entertainment impulse got in the way of this absolute pursuit of the facts that every journalist must pursue.
Well, if you look at my endnotes, I mean, I have probably 40 pages of endnotes where everything I have is documented.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like, and I knew I would get that criticism, and I expected it in a way because, you know, if you use certain storytelling devices, and I only used it when I thought they were warranted and when I had the proof to back them up.
Yeah.
If you know what somebody says and if their behavior follows the course of what they said, you can probably guess what was going on in their head.
Yeah.
So if I slipped myself in their head, it was only during a circumstance when their external behavior and their external actions allowed me to do that and feel uncomfortable with it. So I really tried to make sure that my sourcing was impeccable.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the Gypsy Smith March in 1909
was
interesting because it had a particular after effect of business going up in the Levy District.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you uncovered similar economic correlations here and why those weren't included, or did you? You know. Of reformers coming into the district and saying you must.
Well, because it becomes a form of advertisement.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, oh, the reformers are paying so much more attention to this. What are we, the general public, missing?
Yeah.
It became slumming was one of the favorite pastimes of all the wealthy elite, not only in Chicago but across the country. To go slumming in the red light district. And I think every time, half the reformers didn't agree with this march because they thought they feared it was going to have the effect of increasing business.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in light of this, I also wanted to ask you about the graft money that Ike Bloom collects.
Yeah.
We know that the Everlay sisters paid the most out of all of the parlors that were operating in the Levy District.
Yeah.
And yet, we see the graft money at the very beginning of the book and at the very end of the book, but I wasn't quite so clear as to how they were able to obtain this economic success in relation to the graft money. Was it a matter of charm, or was it a matter of just the fact that they paid more? Did Bloom actually demand the Everlay sisters pay up more? Because he obviously knew that they were quite a commercial success.
Yeah.
So what of this? And I just was curious if you dug up anything that didn't make it into the book.
Yeah, they I think they paid about $120,000 all told over their 11 years. And it was usually the graft fees were dependent on the size of the house and how much money and how profitable you were to the Levy District. And the larger the house, the more you paid. Of course, the Everly sisters, being the largest house and the most profitable house, paid the most. One of my favorite facts about the whole graft arrangement was that state senators were always entertained for free, but if there was going to be harmful legislation poised to pass in Springfield, the Everly sisters wrote a check that could thwart that legislation and get it off the books somehow. I actually am meeting with a man in L.A. next week who is a former president of 20th Century Fox who took Ada Everly out to dinner in the 1950s. I think he's one of the last people that ever met with one of the sisters. And he became quite good friends with them and collected over the years 150 letters from them, artifacts from the club like spittoons and ashtray chairs. He has them in his bed, and he also has a lot of the financial arrangements. And I'm really dying to get my hands on those.
Are you preparing like a second edition of this book? Because the story of their missing years still is unknown. I mean, we have their dealings of Irving Wallace, in which they suggested certain things about themselves that turned out to be not true, that were also contradicted.
Yeah.
You have a number of prognostications based off of various trails, but there is no definitive idea of where they came from in that 12-year gap.
Yeah, I'll see. I would love to go through the letters and see what if they wrote anything about those years, but I don't think that they were years they were eager to talk about. They were, they wanted to leave them permanently out of this narrative that they constructed so carefully. So I don't think they probably ever would have revisited that. I found out that they had become prostitutes through their father because their father pushed them into it from their great niece. So I had that conversation with her, and she said that's what their family always understood. And mostly I got information about their family through just doing genealogy research. And the trustee of the cemetery where they're buried was like immensely helpful in helping me piece all that together. And when their mother died, and when their father died, and when their siblings died. And he actually became so interested in the Everly sisters that he bought the plot of land right next to them so that he's going to be buried there.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there's also something very odd and idiosyncratic about their letters, the three exclamation points in the middle of a sentence and the like.
And Meadow was obsessed with World War II.
Well, there's also something odd because this isn't in the early documentation that you bring up. So something caused the grammar to become more idiosyncratic after their tenure in Chicago.
Yeah.
Were you able to determine the exact point in which they started to go into this? I mean, it's almost like Henry Stephen Keeler.
She wrote that letter to Irving Wallace. Those letters to Irving Wallace were pretty.
Yeah.
I think she had just large looping handwriting. I would love to actually see her handwritten letters. Well, I have actually. The woman who provided me with the new material in the paperback showed me the originals, and there was talk at Random House about scanning them in actually as they were.
Yeah.
But it would have been like 25 more pages because of her handwriting and her punctuation. I think Minna was always eccentric. That was clearly expressed in her writing. She wrote a novel called, and that was even idiosyncratically punctuated. It was Poets, Period, Prophets, Period, Gods, Period. And she had grandiose ideas. I mean, like her first novel is about poets, prophets, and gods. So I think she was pretty much always prone to that sort of thing.
Going back to this idea of how you portrayed various characters or various figures, I want to actually ask you about Vic Shaw. You write near the end of her days.
She's my favorite.
But near the end of her days, you write, she began using dope. Her eyes grew emptier, her body fuller, her mind smaller. And her mind smaller in particular, I don't know if this quite does Vic Shaw justice, you think? I mean, that is really,
you know,
possibly going beyond the nature of telling a colorful story and into this editorialization here.
You know why I said that is because she became, I think when she was queen of the Levee District, she really ruled that roost. She owned that domain, and she did it. She was a smart woman. She couldn't have, even in that sort of degraded, debauched arena, she couldn't have rose to the top like that unless she was a smart, savvy woman. And by the end, she's sitting there with her, in her faded nightgown, with her sad, like, cadre of servants milling about, and her little forlorn pets. And it just seemed like she was such a shrunken version of what she used to be.
Yeah.
So that's what I was really trying to get across there.
But I'm wondering if after...
And she was also a drug addict. I mean, yeah. She fried herself.
She certainly was, but I mean, you know, how can you say that her mind was small? I mean, do we really know what was going on in the latter days of Vic Shaw?
Well, she was a hardcore drug addict. Yeah. I mean, her mind was probably literally, you know, damaged.
Ah, a little bit of a reformist instinct in you.
There you go. You know, I rooted for Vic Shaw. I love Vic Shaw, and I wish she could have come out in a better... had a better final days. It was sad to me that she didn't quit when she was ahead, and she sort of let herself go and she should have gotten out well before she did.
Yeah. There's also Bathhouse John Coughlin, who is the self-described poet laureate, or as he says, laureate.
Yeah.
Who frequented the Levee District, and he had another society person by the name of John Kelly, who was actually... ghostwriting his work.
Yeah.
This reminded me very much of Clement Moore and his whole scam, too. Was this an effort on your part to show that, well, the Levee District, for all of its wonderful debauchery, actually had some colorful culture to it? Or did you want to show this district is not just a den of wonderful sin, or what was the situation?
Well, absolutely. I think that the Levee District ran parallel to, you know, this underworld was just as highly structured and tightly ruled as its, you know, legalized counterpart. I think it was its own insular little world that was perfectly fine, not being bothered with any outside influences, and was so carefully constructed, and everybody had their specific place, and everybody knew their specific place, which is why when the Everly sisters arrived, it threw everything off a little bit, including Vic Shaw. And but I was just fascinated by the you know, everybody who ruled it was a character, and I think they were all probably very innately tough people to survive that era and to rise above in that sort of circumstance and rule an underworld that was as depraved as that one was.
But the sense with Coughlin, what's interesting is that they sort of, all right, go ahead and, you know, we'll let you have your poetry, but they didn't truly appreciate it, probably because they knew that it was obviously a poetic
verification. Yeah, and he was just sort of a buffoon. I mean, he was sort of the bumbling fool of the two lords of the Levee, and which is not to say that I don't doubt he could be vicious when he had to. I think all of these characters could, and as I showed at the end of the book, I mean, the allegiances began shifting, people began turning on one another.
Yeah.
But he covered his vicious streak with the buffoonery, and I think Ike Bloom did as well. Whereas Hinky Dink, his diminutive little sidekick, was probably much more straightforward in what he was thinking, and if he. You know, considered you a threat, you would probably be much more aware of that than if John Coughlin did.
You point out that Al Capone started off as, and many of us know this, he essentially would knock on the madam's doors and warn them of impending busts from the Vice Squad and the like. And yet we have this cataclysmic rush of regulation upon the Levee District roughly around, you know, 1910 to 1920, that particular decade. Was this kind of an inevitable legislative process in Chicago, or was it just a matter of the reformists eventually having to be listened to?
I think it was both of that. I mean, one of the great pleasures of the book was researching the underworld characters before Al Capone arrived. And sort of Capone's shadow, you know, overcast every other... underworld character and every other mafioso character, so it was great fun sort of examining the people that made Capone possible. As for the rush of regulation, A lot of that I would attribute to the reformers, all of the seminal white slavery legislation and what led to the Mann Act. And the Mann Act actually spurred the development of the FBI, which of course becomes much more important in the age of Prohibition and Capone.
Well, here's the thing about the Mann Act that I was wondering throughout this. I mean, you point out that Jack Johnson, the only African-American who was let into the Everly Club, was arrested a year after the Everly Club was closed. Now, this is interesting to me because I'm wondering, one, why they didn't actually go after him when the Everly Club was in existence, because this would have led to a greater closing, more of a threat, more of a sort of the creep of the police, you know, upon all these dens and the like. And then number two, why didn't the G-Men coordinate with the locals? I didn't quite get. Were you able to determine anything like that?
Well, Jack Johnson came to the Everly Club in 1909, and the Mann Act wasn't passed until 1910.
Yeah.
So
there was like a 2-year window here, basically.
Yeah. And I think that so there was that. I mean, the Mann Act wasn't in place yet to go after Jack Johnson, but once it was, you know, the federal government, being that there was no definitive measure of what immoral purposes were, which was the big problem with the Mann Act. You know, once that was established, that they had free rein to sort of persecute anyone or anybody they didn't agree with, that's what let them go full force against him and what Charlie Chaplin and Frank Lloyd Wright and others. But it was interesting to me that one of the Everly Club's main girls testified against him and actually contributed to that whole scandal. So.
Well, absolutely. But I'm wondering, in terms of coordinating the feds with the locals, I mean, we see a lot of the locals and the state legislation coordinating, but not so much with the feds and not so much in relation to the Mann Act. Or was there coordination that just wasn't quite there in the book?
The Mann Act, before the Mann Act was passed, the FBI, it wasn't, I think it was just called the Bureau of Investigation at the time. It was just sort of a bunch of small offices that didn't have much manpower. They were concerned with minor crimes and misdemeanors, and it was only after the Mann Act passed and the Bureau became charged with looking after potential white slavery cases that people actually began devoting resources and men and money to it. It became spurred it to become the federal, you know, the major legal arm it is today. So I think the FBI wasn't even a factor in coordinating with state and local officials until after the Mann Act was passed.
Yeah. But, I mean, was it more?
And then they began coordinating.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, though, if it was more the sort of articles that were published in McClure's and the like, pointing to the terrible things that were going on in the Levee District and all around America. Was it a matter of, you know, Washington eventually coming to Chicago, or was it a matter of the Chicago mayors? Some of them were very laid back about the sin.
Yeah.
Some of them were kind of forced to do something about it. You know, the last mayor at the end. Was it a matter of them coming? Who was coming to who here?
I think it was a convergence of forces. I mean, Chicago's local state's attorney, you know, Clifford Rowe, that state level, was always very vigilant about the red light district. He's the one that started getting the U.S. People involved, the U.S. District Attorney Edwin Sims, who actually authored the Mann Act, and who persuaded, you know, his fellow national level politicians to get involved. So, and I think you're right, all those articles in McClure's and those sort of white slavery narratives that were slowly and then more quickly being disseminated across the country caused such a national furor that people were writing to their elected representatives in droves and begging them to take action. And finally, Taft had to do so. So once Taft jumped in and the federal government officially put its stamp of approval on the whole white slavery phenomenon, all systems were working together after that.
I wanted to also ask you about the bombing in 1908 of the Coliseum. I mean, we don't really know. I mean, this was one of the things that led to the end of the First Ward Hall. Oh, the First Ward Ball, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Was wonderful.
Which was great. Wasn't the First Ward Ball great?
It reminded me of, like, the erotic exotic ball in San Francisco,
I know.
Actually.
It reminded me of, like, the Truman Capote black and white ball, too, on some level.
There's that, too. But the thing that was interesting to me was that the police were very quick to blame this on fanatic reformers.
Yeah.
And yet they weren't willing to raise the possibility of the fact that either they may have done it or possibly many of the underworld people may have done it as a sort of preservationist instinct. We don't know who bombed this.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the following year, the mayor does not issue them the liquor license. Mm-hmm. 3,000 people show up, and then I wonder why Coughlin didn't put up more of a fight for this. I mean, to try to preserve this wonderful public convergence of debauchery. I mean, surely people were interested. He could have gone against this liquor license and served it anyway. He could have tried to keep it going, or money could have been disseminated around to keep it operational. Why did he quit so easy? Were you able to determine anything specific on this?
No, it's a good question. I had wondered that myself. Like I wondered about the Everly sisters at the end, too. Sort of this sort of, well, okay, if that's what they say, we're going to... Well, we will live to fight another day, but we won't pick this battle. I don't know why he didn't fight more for the first word ball. I can only imagine that his major political benefactors maybe were telling him to cool off. But it's nothing. He never wrote anything about why or said anything to the newspaper. So that's the only thing I can guess is that once in a while they got the instinct to just lay low for a while of it and let things calm down, and then they'd come roaring back.
Yeah.
So I'm probably of the thinking that he probably thought the 1999 ball was going to come back, and he was mistaken.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, to what degree were the reformers and the? I mean, it seems to me that up until that 1910 moment, that they were essentially these disparate parties all kind of fumbling around trying to figure out what to do with the problem, whether to keep the levee district operational or whether to actually close it down. I'm wondering, what do you think was the ultimate galvanizing point? Was it shutting down the Everly Club in your view, or was it something else that perhaps happened before that? Was it this ball, the terrible... the so-called terrible... I don't find it that terrible.
I thought it was fabulous. That's an interesting question too. I do think that the reformers weren't so disparate. I think that they worked pretty closely with one another. After like sort of starting off separately, I think they came together pretty quickly. Ernest Bell was very aware of Clifford Rowe. They contributed essays to each other's books.
Yeah.
Rowe had a whole political...
Just to clarify, like the police and the reformers.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I think the police never wanted to shut the Red Lights District down. First of all, they were collecting personal graft money. Second of all, it was... I think a lot of them enjoyed the services in the Red Light District.
Yeah.
A lot of them were agreed with the politicians. And as did some reformers, I should add, that this whole idea of a segregated district was actually beneficial to society.
Yeah.
If a man were inclined to rape or maim or harm somebody or kill somebody, he'd be more likely to go do it in the segregated district to a woman of no virtue rather than attack a respectable society woman. And also, if you kept all the vice in that area, it's not going to trickle off into Prairie Avenue. Or the other well-run neighborhoods. And this was the thinking all across the country in the Victorian era. So, the progressive era reformers are the first ones who challenged that Victorian mode of thinking. And I think that once they started challenging it, a convergence of things led to the eventual decline of the red light districts. The Everly sisters did not help matters by their penchant for advertising. I think that was one of the factors at the end that sort of was the last straw when Minna put out that elaborate brochure about the Everly Club.
And yet the harlots and the sporting girls, to use that the terms of the time, actually... had a very interesting NIMBY-like campaign in which they went outside the levee district and started waving around and showing off their sin to all these other districts. I thought it was a very clever tactic.
Yeah.
But this raises the additional point of why the reformers didn't understand that there is this nested economy within the city that if you were to leave it be, things would be perfectly okay.
Yeah.
People can go about their business. It's zoned in its own weird way, and it's sort of self-supporting, and it doesn't really extend beyond.
Yeah, it's
this
insular.
District.
And that's what a lot of people's arguments were. But Ernest Bell, and he had a point to a certain degree. He said, "No, there are victims here. There are men who come here and then who go home and infect their innocent wives with syphilis.
Yeah.
There are women who then give birth to syphilitic babies. There are prostitutes who are getting murdered there. There are these are white slaves. I mean, that was the change in language about what a prostitute was and a white slave. Nobody cared about prostitutes, but everybody cared about the poor innocent girl who got snatched off the street and became a white slave.
Yeah.
So that was another one of their tactics that was very effective in making people care about women that were initially and for a long time dismissed as prostitutes.
But if the reformers are going after the Everly Club, which has a doctor on staff, which is looking out for these very specific qualities, which is very discreet about the clients who come in and the Johns who come in and go and enjoy themselves, they have a very expensive dinner option for crying out loud. Why go after this? Did they want to go after the Everly Club simply because they knew that it was possibly the one that was most in check, the one that actually had its shit together?
Yeah, I think you're right. It was the shining symbol of open and protected vice, and known throughout the world. So if you're going to make a case against something, you're going to make it against a case against the place that everybody has heard of. You're going to pick on the big guy. So I think that was their method of thinking, and you know, it was just attack what you know and attack what everybody's heard of, and that way we can get publicity for our cause.
But I'm just wondering why they didn't go from the bottom down model, because it seems to me that one option you could have as a reformer is to go after the real dens where there is raging syphilis, where there are like $1, $2 girls. There are a number of disheartening stories of young women who have terrible results because of the way that they were treated, and Vic wasn't exactly...
I know, she wasn't the model of the model madam.
Yeah.
I think to be fair, Ernest Bell did try to go after everybody, but he did see the Everlys. I think that one of his problems with the Everly Club, among many, was that they sought to legitimize the industry in a way that the other ones didn't. You know, they came in and said, if we're going to run this business that everybody's going to run, it's going to happen whether or not it's sanctioned by the police or by anyone else, why not run it as decently, respectably as possible? Let's elevate the industry. And the fact that they were trying to legitimize it to that degree, I think, has scared him, because if everybody followed suit and began trying to legitimize, it might actually become legitimate, which would have been the worst thing that he could have imagined.
Yeah.
So,
in terms of historical cycles, this is intriguing to me, because we see this go on throughout American history, this endless relationship between reformers and libertine instincts. And it seems to me very much predicated, there's this subtle suggestion on your part that it's predicated on economic prosperity. The more prosperous America is, the more that prostitution, gambling, drugs, and the like are allowed to flourish. And yet, when the economic situation is not so gloomy, if we look at the 1905 crisis, for example, then all of a sudden the reformers start to shout at the top of their lungs. Was this one of their motivating factors in writing this book? Is this possibly also a motivating factor in the book you are now working on about Gypsy? Or?
That's interesting. I don't even know if I consciously thought about that when I was researching. I was very aware of, you know, the cyclical nature of religious fundamentalism and the cyclical nature of being xenophobic and very fearful of the outsider and the other. Of course, in that instance, it was, you know, Eastern and Eastern Europeans mostly, and Italians. I'm interested in the way cities develop and the way they evolve, and economics is always a major part of that. In the Gypsy Rose Lee case, you know, one of the big, I read something that was pretty insightful about burlesque and why it flourished during that time period. And it was like burlesque thrives on depression. And it was very, you know, people's seeking of entertainment and what kind of entertainment they seek is very, I think, tied to how the economy is at the time.
In pre-war Berlin, you could make the case for that, too.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Karen, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
With you, too, Ed. All right. Thanks.
Now while she went to Chicago.